All right, we'll get started. Before we get into the lecture, is there any questions from last class or about anything? Yeah.
The first assignment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, so that's a good question. I haven't written it yet. I'll distribute it next week. You'll have 2 weeks to finish it. I don't know where that fits in the schedule, but hopefully that's, yeah.
We don't have any class next Monday.
Is there no class next Monday? Okay, so I'll put the assignment up and send an email when it's posted.
No, I'm asking if there's any class next Monday.
So if Thanksgiving's next Monday, then there's no class. There is no class on Thanksgiving weekend.
Thanksgiving is in 2 weeks from now.
Okay, then there's no class in 2 weeks. So there will be class. I'll let me just double check. Yeah, so there'll be class next week, and then Thanksgiving's October 9th. Other questions? Yeah.
How does second collision resistance imply some pre-image resistance? How are they defined?
Okay, so the question is, how is collision, you mean second collision, or second weak collision resistance?
Yeah,
so there's also no relation. The way that we've defined it, so the textbook has a slightly different notation, so if that's the source of your confusion, that's why. So we formulated things in a slightly different way. In this course, just you can basically just forget about weak collision resistance. So we're not going to care about the relationship between the two.
Okay. But,
yeah. Essentially, from this point on, we'll only consider things that are strong collision resistance. And there's no relationship, yeah, between the two. Yeah. If you want the answer to your question, if you look at the assignment from maybe 2 years ago, that was an assignment question. And there's a solution set. Okay. And so it will explain that. Yeah. Yeah.
In collision resistance, we create two inputs, right?
Yeah.
So those two inputs is given or we have to...
So in strong collision resistance, you get to choose the two inputs.
Okay.
So they can be anything you want. So
we have to find the hash. We have to hash it and we get two outputs. Then we have to choose another input or another again two inputs.
No. So you just keep trying inputs until you see the same output twice. Yeah. And then that's your collision.
And again, we'll match those new outputs with the old ones.
Yeah, in the whole set of old ones. Yeah, so you have a chance of collision with the entire set.
That's why it is, easy to break.
That's right, exactly. So that's why you can break it like a quadratic factor faster. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Mention the line like in PCB loops and a different jump can have the hash map. And you just mentioned WCI and CR meaningful collision. So what does this meaningful collision?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So, I sort of threw this term out without really writing down the definition. If you think of collision resistance, that means you can find two inputs that hash to the same output, as we know. What do these two inputs actually look like? Like, what are they? Are they files? Are they, like, is it two movies that hash to the same output? Like, what exactly is it? Well, if you do the naive attack, they're just going to be two random numbers. Okay, they're not going to mean anything. If they're sitting on your desktop and you double-click on them, they're not going to do anything. And so that's not useful when you want to attack real-world systems that use hash functions. So when you want to attack a real-world system, you actually want to have two inputs that map to the same output where the two inputs are meaningful, meaning they're actually real files. Like one is the file, like the movie, and the other is like the malware version of the movie or whatever. Okay. And so once you can start finding collisions where they're just random, then you can often very quickly, it still takes another leap of insight. But with that leap, then you can start finding what are called meaningful collisions, which just mean that your inputs aren't just random numbers. And so usually the way it works is you'll have a file and you'll have a random number in the file somewhere, okay? And you put it in the file in such a way that the program that's interpreting the file just throws it away. It ignores it. Whatever the case may be, or it's in a spot where it doesn't really matter. And so you can tweak that random number and you can set it to whatever you want. And so that's generally how you go about finding these meaningful collisions. So it's sometimes called the tumor inside the file, which is just some random blob that you can tweak. And you can tweak it on both the sort of real version and the fake version. Anyways, yeah, so this is sort of going outside of the course itself. But if you're interested in that, there's a really nice paper on breaking SSL, which is the protocol where if you go to, like, say, google.com and that little lock appears, that's the SSL protocol. We'll talk about it at the end of the class. And so some people were able to break certificates that used MD5, and they were able to find two different certificates that hashed to the same number. And both certificates were accepted by browsers. One of them was the real certificate, and one was a malicious version. And so they were able to actually break, like, the entire SSL protocol across the net, as long as your library accepted MD5. Then all the browsers dropped MD5 and then moved on. But yeah. And so the way they did it is they got a bunch of PlayStations. And so PlayStations had GPUs, and GPUs weren't, like, really widely available. So they had this, like, big wall of, like, hundreds of PlayStations. And that's actually how they deployed the algorithm. It took them a couple months in order to solve it, but eventually they solved it. So there's a whole paper about it, which you can read about. You can even write about it for your project if you want to do that. It's not on the list of topics, but now you can consider it an approved topic. Okay, other questions?
Yeah. For one input, how many set of possible outputs? The choice of those outputs is random or non-deterministic?
So every hash function only has one output for an input. So every input will only map to one output. So if you come along and you hash the same input today, tomorrow, the next day, you always get the same output. Yeah. So hash functions are by definition deterministic. Yeah, yeah. And we'll never see anything non-deterministic in this class. We will see the same message being mapped to multiple places, but we're going to have some other number, we'll call it the random factor, that's going to select which of the ones it's mapped to. So technically the function itself will always be deterministic. This will make more sense when we see some examples later, but yeah. Okay, other questions? Okay. So where we left off is we started to take a peek inside of a hash function to see what it looks like on the inside. And we didn't go all the way down to, like, this is the code of a hash function, but we looked down one layer and we saw that inside a hash function, there's this sort of miniature version of a hash function called a compression function. And it behaves exactly the same as a hash function, except for a hash function will take any size input and map it to a fixed size output. This will take an input that's twice as big as the output. Okay, so it's not an infinite domain. And so what we're going to do is when we have a message that's way bigger than what we're prepared to operate on, what we're going to do is we're going to take that message and we're going to break it into chunks. And we're basically going to, when we hash it, we're going to start at the start of the file, we'll pull in, say, 256 bits, we'll do something with it, then we'll pull in the next 256, the next 256, and keep going. Okay, and so all hash functions work this way. At least all major ones that are sort of standardized, okay? So the old way of doing it, which is in everything up to SHA-3, is based on something called the Merkle-Damgaard construction. So Merkle-Damgaard were two cryptographers. They are two cryptographers, okay? And so the idea is sort of like this. You start with a message, and your message can really be any size, okay? Or a fancy way of saying any size is to say this, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to, your hash function is going to have an internal state, okay, a size, okay? It's basically what size of chunks it works on, okay? And for all the old Merkle-Damgaard, the output size, D, is the same as the sort of internal state, okay? So what you'll do is you'll pull in, say, D bits. First off, you'll figure out how many D bits you have, okay? So say D is 256, okay? You'll say, okay, I have one 256-bit chunk. I have two 256-bit chunks. And then I have one that's like, it's not quite D, okay? It's like maybe I have another 200 chunks, okay? And so we're going to have to do something with the leftover, okay? But we'll say that this is D as well, okay? And if your file is gigabytes, then you're just going to have, you know, thousands or millions of chunks, okay? So what you'll do is you'll break it into chunks. And so in this case, we're going to have three chunks, okay? We're going to have two completely full chunks, and we'll have one sort of half full chunk, okay? And then what we're going to do is we're going to put it into our compression function, one chunk at a time. And our compression function is going to be a 2-to-1 ratio. So it'll take d bits in, say, from here. It'll take d bits in from here. And we said that the first time you just have some number that was defined by NIST called initialization vector. And it will give you d bits out. Okay? So that's what it does. So it takes 2d in and gives you d out. Or if you want to write it more fancy, okay, so it maps 2 dbit inputs to 1 dbit output. It's a 2-to-1 ratio. That's why it's compression. That's why we use the word compression. And we want our compression function to have the same properties as the hash function itself. Namely, we want it to be pre-image resistant, collision resistant, and weak collision resistant, which is implied once it's collision resistant. Okay, then what we do is we take our next d inputs and we put it through the compression function again. Then we take this output, put it through again. Okay, and we're going to get d bits out, and this is going to be our output. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if your input's 256 bits, you'll take it. You'll just have one chunk or one block. They're called.
But
yeah.
You said, like, functions that are
Yeah. So the question is, how do we deal with that situation? So if a hash function can take any size input, how do you actually write down a function that can take any size input? Right, it's a hard problem. You don't want your function to grow in terms of the size of the input. And so the answer for hash functions is we take it chunk by chunk. So that's how we do it. So we take the first d bits, we process it, then we take the next d bits, process it.
And they decide that based on output.
Yeah, so the for all the hash functions we'll see up to SHA-3, the output size will be the same as the chunk. There's no reason why it has to be. But compression functions will always be 2-to-1, and yeah. And we'll talk about tweaking that for a very specific reason a little later in the lecture. But for now, it's an arbitrary choice, but it happens to be that everything just works in d-bit chunks. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay, and d here you can think of being 256 bits. Okay, that's sort of standard. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Yeah, so the output is of size D. Yeah.
So the how do we fill the padding to place the last chunk?
Yeah, yeah, okay. So we'll go there. Thanks. Okay, so we have this problem where we said the last chunk isn't full. So what we want to do is we want to do some padding. And I hinted last class that doing your padding's non-trivial. Okay, and so I gave the example of so the simplest padding scheme is just fill it all with zeros. Okay, if you fill it all with zeros, that's called zero padding. Okay, does anyone remember the problem with this? Okay, so for example, if my message equals 1, right, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a bunch of zeros on the end. Okay, and then I'll hash that. Okay, if my message is 1, 0, okay, now message M, we'll call this M prime. M prime is not the same as M. Okay, 1 and 1, 0 are two totally different numbers, okay? But when I zero pad it, I'm going to put a bunch of zeros on the end, okay? And it will end up being the exact same block, okay? And once the block is the same, then it's going to go into the function. The other thing's going to be the same in both cases. And so the output's always going to be the same because the compression function is deterministic. Therefore, you found two different messages that hash to the same thing. Okay? So it's a collision. Yeah, not collision resistance. Right. So in this case, the hash of m will equal the hash of m prime. Okay? And it has nothing to do with the compression function. It's just the way that you chose padding. Okay? So how do we get around this particular issue? Yeah, so you want to encode the length of the last chunk?
Well, yeah, I just have to give a safety padding that it fits with the last chunk to make 106 bits.
Okay, sure. So how would we do that? How could we do a padding that's unique for every different bit length? I don't expect you to know it off the top of your head, but... Okay, so special characters won't help you. I mean, this is expecting binary, so we can't escape the fact that we want to use binary here. Put one or
since we are passing zeros,
okay, so if we add one at the end, let me just pencil this in, you'll see that these two still end up being the same. So you're very close. Where else could we add it?
If it's zero.
Okay, we can add it at the start, okay? So if we add 1 and then 0 pad after 1, then that's always unique, okay? And you can sit down and think about why this is actually the case. It seems unbelievable. But basically, our padding is going to be, we have our message. I'll just write it as MMM, okay? And then what we're going to do is we're going to write down the number 1, and then we're going to write down the number 0, and... we'll fill out the rest with zeros, okay? And so you can see in this case, you'll get 110. Here you'll get 101, okay? So it does work in this case, and I'll just state it as a fact that it works in all cases, okay? And you can think about why that's the case, okay? Now, what do you do if your message is exactly 256 bits? Okay, so if you don't pad, then how do you know the difference? Like, say your message is 256 bits and it ends with 10. How do you know the difference between that and something that was padded up to the last two bits? So you don't, right? And so the answer is, if it's 256 bits, you write your 256 bits down, and then you pad in the next block. So your next block will be all padded. You'll write 10000, okay? So you always pad. Even if you don't have to, then you pad, okay? Otherwise, you won't be able to strip the padding off. You won't know whether, when you look at a message, whether you're supposed to strip it off or not.
Okay, yeah. The first bit is 256, right? So I will start with the padding that start of the beginning of the next bit.
Yeah, exactly. So you'll take two blocks. Even though the message fits in one block, you're going to take two blocks, one block for your message and one block for your padding. Now, this isn't strictly necessary in hashing because you never go back. It's more critical in encryption where you can go both forward and backward. So there is this like caveat where you can sit down and think about, you can overthink this problem, and what I say isn't true in the full generality of hash functions. But anyway, that's the basic approach, okay, is to always pad regardless, and you'll never run into trouble. Now, the other thing you can do, so different hash functions do different things. Most of them do this, and then what, like something like SHA-256 will do is they'll also encode the length of the message at the end. Now, you have to be careful here because you have to know how many bits are devoted to encoding the length of your message because it has to always be the same. So this will always have a fixed size. I forget what size they use. Might be like 32 bits or something. And so technically, there is an upper limit to the file or to what you can hash, which is the longest message that you can fit in to this like thing. But this thing is so huge that you could never, you know, you can never make a file big enough that you couldn't hash it. So in practice, it's not a big point. Okay. So both of these approaches work. Okay. You'll see this also in encryption as well, where you will be able to go backwards. And so when you go backwards, you want to strip the padding off. So you're now holding the decrypted value, and you know that somewhere the message ends and somewhere the padding begins. So what you'll do is you'll go look at the end, and it will tell you exactly where that cutoff is based on the length of the message, okay? And so you don't have to, like, parse the whole thing to figure out where it starts and where it ends. You just have that information instantly at your fingertips. So that's why it's sort of nicer in the encryption sense. But, yeah. Questions about that? Yeah.
I have a question initially.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is the input?
Yeah. So let me maybe write this down here as well. So IV. So it's a number chosen by NIST. And it's always the same. So every instance of SHA-256 has that exact same number. It's always the same number regardless of what message you hash. It's a constant that's in the system itself. And they do put some effort into choosing it so that it has nice properties when it goes through this function, but you don't have to worry about those in any details.
I mean, the output will not be changed.
So the output will always be the same because you always use the same value here. Yeah. So every time this value is the same and this value is the same and this is deterministic, the same output.
Same output.
Could you repeat the benefit of writing the length of the thing at the end?
So the length of it shows up more in encryption, where you're going backwards. So you encrypt something and then you decrypt it. And what you want to know is basically you want to get rid of the padding because it's not part of your file, right? So you have this file and there's a bunch of garbage at the end and you want to strip it off. So what this does is you know where to look. Otherwise, you'd have to, like, technically parse the whole file, or at least the last block until you hit the 1-0 and then be like, okay. Or maybe you'd start at the end and go 0-0-0-1 and then, yeah.
You know.
But here you would know instantly, and you don't even have to read these bits in. You can just chop it. Yeah.
You have to put length in every block.
Yes. No. So this is just at the end of the message. So this is the last block only. Yeah. Only in the last block. Yeah.
So that's just the last block. What did you mean by pad?
What I meant is that you always pad a message regardless of its length. So the one place where it'd be tempting not to pad is, let's say your message was a perfect multiple of D. So it was exactly 256 bits or is exactly, you know, 512 bits. Then it fits cleanly into a certain set of blocks. And then you might be like, well, I don't need to pad it because there's no like leftover space. But the problem is that can be indistinguishable from something that was padded. Yeah. Okay.
After padding the message, you have many blocks of about 156 bits. And after the slice, you have the block of 32 bits. Do you have to add it?
Yeah. So what you'll do if you're adding the length, basically what you'll do is you'll be like, okay, I have this much to fill up the block, right? And from the end, I need this much to encode the length. And if there's some difference, then you'll pad in between. And if when you calculate the length, it overlaps with it, then you fill into the next block. Yeah. So let's say that we have a message. Let's say we have 256 ones. Okay, that's our message. So 1111, 256, right? So your whole message is sitting here. There's no leftover space, right? And so you would be tempted to just take this one block in, take your IV in, and then output this. So what I'm saying is what you should do is you should pad this message, and it will be the entire block will be padding. Yeah, you're taking an extra D bits, that's all padding.
Because we're writing on the same message that is on the top, so it seems like it's going to pad in the message that is.
Yeah, so maybe this isn't the best diagram, but yeah, think about if this filled up this entire block here, then you would create a new a new block. And so I did denote like the padding's supposed to go, you can think of it as going sort of up here, like kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah. So you pad the message before you process it. Yeah. Yeah. So for hash functions, it's you don't need it for hash functions, but I'm sort of jumping ahead. So I'm trying to give you a generic padding that's going to work both for encryption and hashing. So in encryption, what happens is you'll have a message, you'll pad it up because it's going to get processed block by block. But when you receive the message, you're going to decrypt it. So you're going to be looking at the message plus the padding. Right? So you'll be sitting there, you'll be looking at something, and it's like, and you don't know where the message ends and where the padding begins, right? And before you write that file, say it's a file, before you write it to disk, you want to get rid of the padding because that could mess up the file itself, right?
It's used
after the decryption, yeah. And so then what you'll do is you'll just go to the end of the file, it will tell you the length, then you'll find that location, you'll just chop it off. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
You don't take the extra block for padding, you just take that block for writing down the length of the padding that you've done in the first block, right?
So this is the length of the message, not the padding.
And this is the extra block that we're using.
So it depends. So if you can fit this and this in the same block, then that's fine. So the corner, we're all getting hung up on this corner case where it's just like, once you add all the padding, it spills into the next block. Then that's fine. Just let it spill into the next block. Yeah.
So if the block is same like a padding.
Yep.
Actually, message is all included.
Yeah.
Because it's message being cutting part.
Yeah.
It's seem to be like a padding message, then how good can you control it?
So what we, if it's all zeros, it doesn't matter. The padding is only to deal with this problem where your message is not exactly the right length. So you, this function wants d bits to come in, and it can't take any less than d bits. Okay, and so if you have less than d bits, then you have to fill up the rest with something. And you have to do it in a way that you can't trivially find collisions. Does that answer your question? Or is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
If the last block is like 1, 1,
yeah.
Only 2 bits, so we'll put padding in the front? Like,
no, yeah, so let's say that the last block is 1, 1. Okay, so this is the end of the message. Okay, then what we're going to do is we're going to write 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, okay, 0. And then what we'll do is, we don't know what the message is. Like, if there might have been previous blocks. So this might be a 2, like the length of message might be 2 if this is the only block. But if there's other previous blocks, then it's whatever the length is. And we encode that at the end. Does that make sense? Yeah, and then this whole thing will be d bits. Okay, and we'll make this. We can make any size we want. It's like we can stretch it out or shrink it down. Yeah. And if we can't fit all of this in, then we spill into the next block.
Isn't the length of the message the last block or the length of the
message? So it's the length of the entire message, and the reason is it's easier to chop off. And the other reason is that if you have a perfect multiple, I guess you could encode 0 as the length of the message in the last one. But anyways, for whatever reason, yeah, they do encode the length of the entire message itself. Yeah. So there's more than one way. This isn't like the only way. This by itself is sufficient. This by itself with, say, just 0 padding here is also sufficient. Okay, if you do 0 padding, notice the length will be different, right? Here will be 1 bit, here will be 2 bits. So that's why these two will end up different, even if you 0 pad. And then there's a million other padding schemes as well. So the point is that it's not hard to find these padding schemes. It's just you have to be careful how you choose them. Yeah. Okay, so this padding, is, yeah, it does it two different ways. It's sufficient, and it works for both hashing and encryption. So later when we talk about encryption, we won't have this discussion again. We'll just assume we're using this style of padding. Okay, other questions? Okay. Now, there's a problem with Merkle Dam Guard, okay? And I alluded to it before when we talked about malleability. So this time, I'm just going to state exactly what the problem is. So there's an issue with, I'm going to put issue in quotes, because technically it doesn't violate collision resistance, pre-image resistance, or weak collision resistance. So you might argue, well, it's not an issue because we weren't shooting for anything more than that. But still, we sort of have this idea of that hash functions are random, okay? And so this is an instance of a hash function behaving in a non-random way, okay? And we don't like that even if we didn't explicitly write it down, okay? So it's called a length extension attack. No, that was a collision attack. Yeah, so this will be different from this. Yeah, but you can do this attack on MD5 as well. Yeah, you can do it on any. I'll write down what you can do it on and which ones you can. Okay. All right. So this is the attack. So let's say that I give you an output of a hash function for some x, but I don't tell you what x is. What you can do is you can choose any value, we'll call it A, okay? And you can compute the hash of X concatenated with A, even though you have no idea what X is, okay? So you have no idea what X is, but you're able to compute this sort of related value, okay? So the example I gave, which is kind of silly, but imagine this is kind of like your salary or something like that, and you want to add some zeros onto the end, you can do that, okay? But you have to concoct a bigger scenario where that actually makes sense, because the person doesn't know that you added the zeros on, but anyways, that's fine. Okay, so actually, yeah, so you can think of it as, like, say you see this hash go by, whatever, forget about the scenario, but that's the idea, you can add zeros on. There's a very practical scenario, which we'll talk about later. I hinted that we're going to talk about these sort of signature-like functions that use the same symmetric keys. They're called max, and there's a very natural way that you would want to do max that breaks because of this property. This is why this became such a big deal, is because you want to do these max, and there's a very natural way of doing it, and you can't do it that way, okay? So we'll see that later when we actually talk about max. But for now, we'll just consider it a generic property, okay? Now, how is this possible? This seems really weird, right? You have no idea what X is, so how could you just add A on to the end? And I should denote this as a different Y. I'll call it Y prime. Okay, so the value of Y is going to change, obviously, because the input changes. Okay, and so it's basically a function of the way Merkle Dam Guard works. Okay, so let's look back at Merkle Dam Guard. And what we could do is actually just copy and paste this. Okay, so we'll forget about the padding and all those details. Okay, so what does the hash of X look like? Let's start with this guy. So Y equals the hash of X. Well, X is a certain number of blocks long, okay? We don't know how long it is. It doesn't really matter. I'll put three dots in here to denote it could be any length. Call it Xn, the last block. Put three dots here. Okay. And what comes out here is Y, okay? This value is Y itself. Okay. Okay. So that's what the first part of this thing looks like. So y equals the hash of x. what does y prime equal the hash of x concatenated with a mean? Okay, what would it look like? Like, say you actually knew what x was, you chose your a, and now you're going to compute x concatenated with a. Okay, so what you'll do is you'll write down your x in terms of blocks, then you're going to add this thing on the end, so we'll call it a. We'll just assume it fits into a single block. Okay, and so what you'll do is you'll take in your compression function, you'll take in your next block, you'll run it through, and your output will be y prime, right? Okay. Now, let's say we want to compute y prime. What do we need to know to compute y prime? So to compute y prime, we need to know what f is, which we know it's a public function, okay? And f has two inputs. One input is a, we're choosing a, we know what that is, no problem. What about the other input? Do we know this value here? So this is the hash of x, right? This is actually the same value as y here, which is the output, okay? So what we can do is, because Merkle-Damgard works chunk by chunk, what you can think of is when you see a value like the hash of x, what it really means is someone took x, broke it into chunks, and operated it chunk by chunk, and then they just stopped at some point, okay? And what y is kind of like that stopping point. It's where they stopped. So you can pick up that y, right? And you can keep going, right? You can just keep adding stuff onto the end. So y is kind of like the internal state of your hash function, okay? Let me describe it a slightly different way. If you start computing the hash of x, okay, so you start here, you get x1, you run it through f. And let's say you're holding this value in your hand. Do you need to know x1 anymore? No, because everything about x1 is encoded into this value here, okay? Then you grab x2, right? Then you grab xn. And once you're holding this value, do you even care about any of those? You don't, right? So you have the complete state here. And so if you want to just keep going with that state, you can, okay? So when you actually put the output of the hash function, you can think of it as leaking the entire internal state. So someone else could take up that state and just keep going, okay? And so that's bad. We don't like this property at all. Okay? Yeah?
So what about the size of the message on the last block?
You mean in terms of xn here?
Yes.
Or in terms of a?
Xn.
Xn, yes. Yeah, so what happens is technically when you do this, you're getting the hash of x concatenated with the padding concatenated with a. And then you'll add your padding onto the end of a. So you're going to get padding as part of the X itself. Yeah. So, but just forget about the padding issue because it kind of confuses things. Yeah.
What if the last XN is padded? Then why won't the exact value of it keep adding A?
Exactly. So that's the same question. Yeah. So for the purpose of this course, ignore padding. When you see the attack applied to max, you'll see that the fact that what you're getting is the hash of X concatenated with the padding, concatenated with your A, and then the actual padding for the new message on the end. And it doesn't matter. Like, the attack will still work in that scenario. So you can safely ignore the padding for this issue. But the earlier example where I'm like, add a couple zeros onto the end of your salary, it obviously breaks down because of the padding issue. Yeah.
Actually, if I add A, so actually the final output will be changed.
That's right. Yeah. So y prime is not equal to y.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. So, yeah. Let me write y here just so that we know. But yeah, keep going.
So actually, the peer is still okay, right?
Sorry. So this doesn't break. Yeah, it doesn't break pre-image resistant. You still have no idea what x is.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're able to compute this. Not only were you not given x, but even when you're all done the attack, you still didn't learn anything new about x. Yeah.
So we can change the integrity, but not
the... Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so you can think of it that way. So x is confidential, so we're sort of breaking the integrity of the protocol without breaking the confidentiality.
Actually, we are changing the output.
Yeah, that's right. So y prime is not the same as y. Yeah, so just hold it until we see the max. It'll make a lot of sense there, okay? Just consider it a curiosity that you can do this, and trust me that it breaks something. Okay, other questions? Okay, so how can we fix this? So remember, the fundamental problem is that when we output y here, we're outputting the entire state, like the entire internal state. So someone can just take that value, pick it up, and keep operating. Okay? So the easiest solution is, when we output y, don't output all of it. Output half of it. Okay? Now, if we output half of it, well, we need this to be 256 bits. We want 256 bits out. So that means the output of our compression function should be twice as big. It should be 512. Then the inputs here should be 512 as well. So if we go through the hash function, we kind of double the internal state all through the hash function, then what we'll end up with is a 512-bit value, but we only need 256 bits of it. So we just take the first 256, and then we throw away the other 256 bits. Okay. Now, if somebody wants to compute this attack, they know what A is, but they only know half of Y. Okay? And they could exhaustively search the other half, but if it's 256 bits, then that's going to be 2 to the 256 work. That's too much work. Okay? So that's the first solution. So let me draw it, and then you'll be clear. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're just going to turn these D's into, say, 2D, okay? So like 512 bits instead of 256 bits, okay? Then the output here is going to be 2D, okay? And instead of saying here's all 2D bits, what we'll do is, so you can think of our output as looking like this. So there's some D bits here, and there's some D bits here. And what we'll do is we'll just take, say, the last D bits, okay? And then we'll say, okay, this is our actual output. Okay? Then if you want, so this is all anyone knows, okay, about the hash of X. They know this half. But if they want to pick up and keep going, they're going to have to know this other D bits here, okay? And so you can think of this as sort of a secret that never gets revealed. So you throw away. Okay. So that's, yeah. So you don't in hash functions. So this would not work in a reversible scenario. So this is a specific to hash function solution because you never go backwards. So 2D means that you're taking 500, say D is equal to 256, you're going to take it 512 bits at a time. And then it's the exact same policy. At the end, you're going to have not exactly 512 bits, and so you'll pad up the rest. No, so you only pad at the end. Yeah, so you'll take full blocks of data, and then at your very last data, that's where you're padding. Other questions? Okay, the other thing we can do is we can use a totally different data structure. So in decryption, we're not going to have this length extension problem. That's the simplest answer. But. Yeah, that's right. So all you're trying to do, remember with a hash function, is you're trying to create a kind of fingerprint of this file, right? And so you can throw away half of the data, and this will still be a unique number, right? And if you change any one of these bits, this number is going to change. I mean, the whole thing will change, but this number is going to change as well. Yeah. So there's no harm in throwing it away. What if it's not equal to 2D? Then we pad the first message. So if your first message, let's say you just want to hash bit 0, you write down 0, and then you pad, and then you pad it up to 512, and then you process. Yeah, so the IVs still, the IVs, oh, sorry, so you need, are you saying you need your IV to be twice as big?
No, what I'm saying is, so these are high as
well. Yeah.
That means you're going to find it, then don't have IV.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, so the IV will be twice as big, so it's now 512 bits instead of 256 bits, and then the compression function works exactly the same. So it takes your one-bit message padded up to 512. It takes a 512-bit IV and gives you a 512-bit output. Yeah, so we're not breaking anything by doing this. Other questions? Okay. The other thing we can do is we can use a different data structure. And so this is what SHA-3 does. So they have, let me actually write it here. And there's different ways of doing it. Like MD6 had this tree kind of structure, and then the winner of the SHA-3 competition, they use this kind of sponge construction. I'm not going to test you on it. I'll just show you what it looks like. I actually have it drawn out already. So it works kind of the same. You have this function that's like a, in this case, it's actually a bijective function, meaning that the input size and the output size is the same. So it doesn't do any compressing for you. So what you do is you start off with a bunch of zeros. This is kind of like your initialization vector. And you take a chunk, in this case, a big chunk, like 1088 bits. You XOR it in, and you're going to XOR it in chunk by chunk. Okay, and so you can think of this as sort of there's a top register and a bottom register. The message only ever directly touches the top register, and then the bottom register will have this sort of mixed into it by virtue of the function itself. So you'll take your first message, you'll take put it through F, and then you're going to get a sort of random output here, and then you'll fold in your next message into the top register. And you'll basically go all the way along until you process your whole message. Then what you do is you squeeze out your bits. So what you do is you take these values and you pop off some value. And anyway, this is a very generic structure where for a hash, you're popping off a small value that's much smaller than the state. But there's other functions that we'll see in crypto, like pseudo-random number generators and things like that. And so this structure you can use to squeeze out more than 256 bits, you can squeeze out more than 1088 bits, you can keep going. So the idea of a sponge is you sort of absorb the message and then you squeeze it out at the end. But anyway, the main reason you can't do length extension is actually the same reason, it really comes down to the same reason above, which is that in order to pick up and keep going, what you would need to do is you'd have to know the entire internal state, and the internal state is much bigger than the actual output itself. So you're not getting the entire internal state. Now there's also a sort of absorption phase and then an output phase, and they're different. So you also couldn't pick up and keep going for that reason. So anyways, that's like, I don't expect you to understand this. I'm not going to test it, but it's just to give you a sort of high level view of what the latest and greatest sort of hash function uses. Questions on that?
Last 256 bits, not necessarily they have the whole message. They have
so this will have, it will have the whole message folded into it. Okay. Yeah.
So it's not like the other one, you divide the hash.
So in this case, these bits, you can think of the leftover bits are getting thrown away.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to put a fine point on this. I mean, this design is very integrate. You could read an entire paper on why it's chosen. In 5 minutes, I'm not going to convince you that it solves any meaningful problem. But. Yeah, so it solves more than one problem, more than a hash function. It doesn't solve every single function, but it solves a few. Yeah. You can do your project on this. I think it is in the list. So if you want to look at the sponge construction and understand like why everything is the way it is and what it's doing for you, then that would be a suitable project. Okay. Okay, other questions? Okay, so just in terms of hash functions themselves, so we looked at some major ones, including MD5, SHA-1, SHA-2, SHA-3. So as we just saw, SHA-3 uses a sponge. That means there's no length extension attack. Okay. These three all use Merkle Dam Guard. And so they're all susceptible to the length extension attack. Okay. So if you're using SHA-256 in your applications today, you should know that this attack is possible and you might want to pay attention to making sure you're not making any assumptions that this attack would break. Okay, so the final thing is we saw a hash function. This is what it looks like inside, but we still don't know what F looks like, right? So what does a compression function of a hash function actually look like? So I'll give you an example, and this will be another thing I'm not going to test you on. And what I'm going to show you is, the reason I'm showing it to you is just so that you don't think it's magic, okay? It is something you can write down. It's not that complicated. And we'll draw a few points. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick a really simple compression function, one that I can get on one page. And so what I'm going to show you is actually MD4, which predates MD5. Okay, so this is really, really old. But SHA-1, SHA-2, SHA-3, they do sort of similar things, but they do it. It's obviously going to be a lot more complicated. But I'll show you an example of a compression function. I'll add a little disclaimer. All right, so it's very old, it's insecure, you should never use it. This is only for educational purposes. Okay, so this is what it looks like. I'll just copy and paste it into the notes. Okay, so what it's going to do is, first off, just for convenience, we're going to take its input. So I forget MD4, excuse me, I forget what size its internal state is. Did I write it down? I think it's like, it's very small, like maybe 64 bits or something like that. But anyways, what we're going to do is we're going to think of it as four kind of chunks. Okay, and we'll call them A, B, C, D, okay? So we're going to take four chunks of our message, we're going to take four chunks of our initialization vector if it's the first round or our previous, the output of our previous round, and then we're going to compute four new chunks, A, B, C, D, prime, okay? And the way we're going to do it is we'll start with the second line first. So our new chunks, four chunks, are going to be the previous chunk that was down here. We're going to shuffle it to the front, okay? We're going to put B and C here, so we're sort of going to reorder it, okay? And then for this middle value, what we're going to do is we're going to compute some value T, which I'll talk about in a second, and we're going to do a bit rotation of it by some constant amount, okay? So all this line does is it sort of scrambles things up. It mixes the order of things up, plus we're going to actually play with this value. We're going to change it, okay? How are we going to change it? Okay, we're going to take chunk A, we're going to do addition module, whatever the size of our number of bits are, and then we're going to compute this function on B, C, D. Okay, we'll add in our message and we'll add in some constant that's set by this. Okay, and this GI can look different ways depending on where we are in the function, but here's a few examples. So there's basically three. And what you see is it's just logical operations, ands and ors and nots of the other chunks, okay? So all we're doing, or and XORs as well, okay? All right, so what's the point of all of this? The point of all of this is, first off, all the operations are logical operations, okay? There's no math or anything like that, okay? It's just like XORing things together and anding things together and inverting things and XORing and all that stuff, okay? So it's like a logical blender where you're sort of blending these objects, okay? That's the first lesson. The second lesson is the way it works is through repetition, okay? So instead of doing a big, long, complicated algorithm, what you do is you write down a very, like a relatively short algorithm, but you repeat it a bunch of times, okay? So it's like a blender where it's like going around and around and around, and it's over time that the randomness sort of filters out from. So initially, you're basically just reordering things, and it's like this is the only value that's actually changing, right? But then in the next round, you reorder it again, and then the value that was like here ends up here and it changes. And so the more times you do this, the sort of randomness of everything kind of circulates amongst these four values, okay? So what you're going to do is you're going to repeat this 15 times, okay? So you're going to shuffle it, mess up this value, repeat, shuffle it, mess up this value, repeat. And then what you're going to do is you're going to repeat that whole 15 times and three times, okay? The first time, you're going to use this function, g1, right? So you're going to do 15 times with this, then you're going to do it 15 times with this, and then you're going to do it 15 times with this, okay? So that's what a compression function looks like, okay? Now, can you sit here and look and say that's secure? Like, that's obviously collision resistant and obviously pre-image resistant? No. You would have to, like, even me, you know, I've done crypto for over a decade, I can't sit down and really analyze that, okay? That's a specialized skill called cryptanalysis. Some people, like if you took this course with Amr Youssef, he could probably say more sensible things about why this is designed the way it is, okay? This is like really hard, right? People get PhDs in figuring out how to analyze this, okay? So the reason I'm showing it to you is just to say it's not magic, okay? It's based on logic, and it's also based on a lot of repetition. Okay, repetition's important because what you can do is, if you want to attack this algorithm, maybe you're not able to attack it if you repeat it, you know, 15 times three times, but maybe you do it the first 15 times and you find collisions, right? And then next time you do it 30 times, right? And then you find collisions. And so you can sort of ramp up to being able to find collisions. And that's really good for the community too, because we know, oh, we're getting close to finding collisions because people can find it after a reduced number of rounds, okay? So it's not just like one day it's like secure, 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 and then the next day someone drops a bomb and it's insecure, okay? It's more like we can do kind of incremental work on attacking smaller round versions and then getting closer and closer to attacking the full version of the or the hash function in this case. Okay, questions? Yeah. How is it broken? So collisions you can find, and I don't know about pre-images, if they've been found or not.
Yeah. Is it just because the size?
So I believe there's internal weaknesses as well. So it's more than just the size itself. Yeah. Okay, questions about this? Okay. Is which? So I won't test you on any of this in the exam, this MD4 function. I'll test you on Merkle-Damgaard. You should know Merkle-Damgaard, but you don't have to know how the compression function works. You should know the high-level details, like it works in rounds and things like that. But, obviously, yeah, like, what would I ask you? Yeah. So constants are just numbers that are set by NIST, or whoever Ron Rivest in this case, the designer of the algorithm. So they're just picked, and it's always the same. So they might change every round, so there might be a list of constants depending on which round you're in. But they're all listed. You can read what they are, and every implementation will use the same constants.
So it wouldn't be on
Wait, first round is one, then second round is something else.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so you'll have 45 different constants for this argument. Well, actually, 2 times 45, because this one's probably different than this one. So there's actually 2 constants there. And I don't think there's no constants on there. Okay, other questions? Okay, any other questions about hash functions? We're done with hash functions. You now know how they work from the inside out. So you know the properties, you know what they look like, right? You're all experts now. Okay, no questions? Okay. Yeah, exactly. That's fine. Okay, so we'll move on to the next topic. Actually, you know what? Since we're going to be on a break in 10 minutes, why don't we take our break a little early? So let's take a break now. We'll come back at 7, and then we'll go into the next topic. Okay. Okay, we'll get started. All right, so the next topic we're going to talk about is randomness. This is going to be important moving forward. We didn't really see randomness in the hash function itself because there were no secrets, there was no keys. We did assume randomness when we were thinking of how a hash function behaves, right? It sort of generates a random output. So technically, we did see it in terms of the analysis itself. But anyways, moving into the rest of cryptography, randomness will be really important. It's going to play an important role. So before, we should start to think about what exactly is randomness. Does anyone want to hazard a definition of what randomness is? Okay, can someone give me an example of randomness?
Noise.
Noise, okay. So why is noise random? Okay, tossing a coin. Let's use that. It's a little cleaner. Okay, what about tossing a coin is random? Why do we say tossing a coin is random? Okay, so I'm hearing entropy, blah, blah, blah. Like, just tell me. Okay, so I heard unpredictable. Okay, so it's unpredictable. There's something uncertain about the outcome. Okay, so that's essentially what randomness is. It's uncertainty. About a future outcome. Okay? And it's important to know that that doesn't mean you don't know anything about the future outcome. Okay? So, for example, with a coin, you know that half the time you're going to see heads, half the time you're going to see tails. Okay? And so you can know information about a future outcome. Okay? And it can still be uncertain or it can still be random. Okay, so randomness is almost like a measure. Okay, it's like a metric as opposed to something that either is random or not. We should think more in terms of how random is something. Okay, let's say I have a coin and every time I flip it, it flips heads. Is that more random or less random than a normal? It's less random, right? It's actually not random at all, right? Because you know what the outcome is going to be before you flip it. Okay, so that's sort of where we're going. Now, we define the opposite of randomness to be information, okay? So this is how we're going to use the word information. It's used in a lot of different contexts. This comes from something called information theory. And so information is something that resolves randomness. Or it reduces the uncertainty. Okay? And the more randomness it removes, the more information that there is there. Okay? So we're going to, ultimately what we want to do is we want to measure information. Okay, so let's work towards, what we want to do is we want to come up with a measure. Okay, so we want to measure information and randomness, and they're sort of opposites. We want to measure them like we measure inches or we measure pounds. Okay, we want to have a metric. Okay, and just like an inch and a pound, like why is an inch as opposed to like slightly bigger, slightly lower? It's kind of arbitrary. Okay, and so what's important is the relative difference. Okay, so we're going to similarly define an amount of randomness that's somewhat arbitrary in terms of what it is, but where it's really useful is by comparing different things. Okay, so what it will allow us to do is say you roll a dice, it's six-sided, and you're going to roll it three times, or you're going to flip a coin, you know, eight times. Which has more randomness? Which are you more uncertain about in terms of the outcome? Okay. So that's what this is going to allow us to do, okay? And the only input that this function is going to take is what's the uncertainty we have about the outcome, okay? And the uncertainty is something we know how to measure, even if we've never seen information theory before. How do we measure uncertainty?
Probability,
okay? So uncertainty is probability, okay? What is probability? So probability is a number between 0 and 1, okay? If it's 1, that means it happens with certainty. If it's 0, it's impossible, never happen. Okay? And anything in between, right? Some odds, right? More likely closer to 1 and less likely the closer to 0. Okay, and sometimes we express it as a percentage, which you can think of as well. In that case, it would go from 0 to 100 instead of 0 to 1. Okay, we're going to, when we write down probabilities, we're going to write them in their decimal form, not in their probability. Okay, and the other thing is, let's say we have a set of outcomes. Where one of the outcome will happen. We don't know which one, but it's going to be one from this set. Okay? Then what we have is we call it a probability distribution. So I'll say one will happen. Okay? And we can think of a probability distribution as whatever, P1, P2, P3, Pn, okay? And the big property that we have is since one will happen, what does that mean? It means if you add all these properties, probabilities up, it's going to sum up to one, okay? So these are going to be a bunch of probabilities and the sum of them will be one. Okay, the second thing we want to do is we want to define information. And then when we define information, we're going to define randomness. So I'm going to try and deviate from the notes a little to make this clear. Okay, let's consider the amount of information. Well, let's consider a probability distribution. You know what? I'm actually going to skip. We won't talk about information. I'm just going to go straight to randomness. So I'll show you where information comes in into randomness itself. I'm trying to find the easiest path through this because people find the equation very unintuitive. I think this will help. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to write down a definition of randomness. Okay. And what the randomness will do is, very confusingly, we're going to call it H, which is not a hash function. And this is just standard. And just to differentiate it, I'm going to put a little subscript 2, and I'll talk about why it's 2. So it's standard to use H, not a hash. And what we call this is entropy. Okay, so that's the term that we're going to use. So randomness and entropy are the same thing. Entropy is the measure of randomness. Okay, and so what we're going to measure the entropy or the randomness of is a probability distribution. Okay, and when we measure the probability distribution, just like I said, why is an inch an inch? Why is the entropy of something whatever it is that comes out the other end? It's sort of arbitrary, okay? And so the person who invented entropy, or this flavor of entropy, his name was Claude Shannon, and he basically sat down and said, well, I kind of have a sense of how I want this function to behave, so let's kind of write down what we think this function should look like, and then we'll find a mathematical relationship that realizes these properties, okay? And so what he thought was, all right, so these were sort of why entropy looks the way it looks. Okay, so he said, well, first off, let's say that we have a certain event, okay? If we have a certain event in a probability distribution, then we're going to have one thing that's one, okay? And there can't be any others, or you can consider them zeros, whatever. But once one is certain and all of them have to add up to one, it's like you have one event, okay? And what do we think the randomness, what's a good number for the randomness of a certain event? You have a certain event, there's no randomness there. What number would we like to denote no randomness with?
Zero.
Zero would be great. You could do one, that would be another one, but zero is intuitive, okay? So he said, well, that's great. So let's set the randomness of one to be zero, okay? Then he thought, well, what about a coin flip? So coin flip's kind of like an inch, right, or a gram or something like that. It's kind of like the most basic unit of randomness, okay? So we have this basic unit of randomness. What's the probability distribution of a coin flip? So the probability of a heads is a half, and the probability of tails is a half, okay? And he said, let's make that one, okay? So a coin flip is one unit of randomness, okay? So this is a coin flip. Okay, and if it's a unit, we should have a name for the unit, just like we call inches, inches, and centimeters, centimeters. Okay, so what are we going to call it? Well, a coin is, there's two outcomes, right? It's like a binary outcome, zero or one. And so what he thought is, well, let's call it bits. Okay, the unit of randomness will be bits. And there is an easy way to change, when you see the formula itself, you can talk about not bits. You could talk about bytes of randomness or something like that if you want. There's an easy way to extend it. But for the purposes of this course, we're always going to be talking about binary strings, zeros and ones. And so we'll always think in terms of bits. Okay? And then the idea is that the entropy of some probability, like say you have a dice, right? And so a dice would be like 1, 6, 1, 6, 1, 6, 6 times, okay? Is that more random than a coin or less random than a coin?
More
random, okay? So what should happen to the entropy? What should happen to the entropy? If the entropy of a coin is one bit, should that be a number that's bigger than one or a smaller than one? So it's more random, right? We say when the least amount of randomness, when there's certainty, that's zero. When we have a coin worth of randomness, that's one. Now we're having a die roll worth of randomness, that's even more. It's going to be bigger than one, okay? So entropy, unlike unlike probability, it doesn't stop at 1. Okay, so you have entropy greater than 1. That just means there's more randomness than a particular coin. Okay, so entropy itself will run from 0 to infinity. Okay, so it'll be somewhere in between those bounds. Okay, if it's bigger than 1, that means it has more randomness than a coin flip. What about something that's less than 1? Could it be a decimal amount? Could you have like 0.5 bits of randomness? So the answer is yes. So for example, if you consider a bias coin, right? Let's say you have a coin and 60% of the time it flips heads. Is that random? Can you predict what the outcome will be? You still can't predict it with certainty. Okay, so we can't say that that has randomness 0. Okay, but is it less random or more random than a coin that flips 50-50? It's less random, right? It's more predictable. It's easier to predict. So it's somewhere between 0 and 1. Okay, so we can have decimals if you want as well. Okay, so if you think of entropy on a scale, it's sort of like this is certainty. You can think of kind of having like a biased coin. Okay, and then at 1, you have a coin flip. Okay, and then it can keep going. Okay, now what if you want to flip 4 coins? Okay, 1 coin has 1 bit of randomness. How much should 4 coin flips have? 4, right? Why not? Right, and then you can just multiply it through. Okay, and so that's the final thing that entropy has is so the entropy of a single event multiplied by some number of trials so I should denote this slightly different. Let me just write in English. If you repeat event, uncertain event, n times, the entropy is n times the entropy of a single event. Okay? So if you flip a coin 100 times, how many bits of entropy is that? It's 100 bits. Okay? If you flip a coin 64 times, you get 64 bits of entropy. Okay, so these are all the constraints. Okay, so we need some function that when you evaluate it at 1, it gives you 0. When you evaluate it at 1/2, it gives you 1. When it has this like multiplicative property. And so writing down a function like that is a little hard and it looks a little weird. So what I want you to do is not get weirded out by it, but just understand that it is the function that realizes all of these very natural properties, even if it doesn't look very natural itself. Okay. So this is sometimes called Shannon entropy. We distinguish it from a different type of entropy called min entropy, which this year I think I'm going to skip in the interest of time. But I'll talk about when you need one and when you need the other. Okay. So the entropy of some probability distribution is going to equal minus pi times the log base 2 of pi minus p2 times the log 2 of p2, et cetera, et cetera, minus pn times the log base 2 of pn. Okay? So the logarithm of 1 is 0. Once this is 0, when you multiply by anything else, it's 0. And so that's what's going to give you this property. Now, you might be like, well, what's the logarithm of 0? So what's the logarithm of 0?
That's an error.
Okay, so it's an error. It's undefined. And so entropy cheats if they define the log of 0 to be 0. Okay, so if you have something that's exactly 0, which you might want to stuff into your probability distribution, your term just goes to 0. And so what they do is they basically say just ignore If you have any zeros in your probability distribution, you can just drop them. But if you really want to stick a zero in this equation, it's going to mess it up. So that's the only caveat, okay? And then otherwise, this sometimes is defined by itself. So just this term itself, we call the information a PI. Okay, so sometimes we'll talk about the bits of information. Then you can think of Shannon entropy as a weighted average of the information of each of its probabilities. Okay, so that's another way of thinking about it. The best way to think about it is not think about it, just memorize it. Okay. And know that it was defined with those sort of properties in mind. Okay, another way you can, if you want to write it just slightly shorter, you can write it as the sum of all PI log PIs. Okay, another thing that we won't talk about in this class, but you could change that base 2 to base 10 or whatever you want. Then you're not going to get bits of entropy. You're going to get decimals of entropy or bytes if you change it to log 16. Okay, but it's fine. The relative nature of a coin flip being less random than a dice roll, et cetera, is all going to maintain the right properties. Okay, so for this course, we'll always do log 2. If you're in an exam and you want to compute the log 2 of something, and your calculator only has the log 10 of something, what do you do? Sorry? Okay, don't take it by chunks. Okay, so I'm sitting on the exam, right? And I'm like, okay, what's the log 2 of whatever, 57? Okay. Okay, so we only have a log 10 button. Okay, so we're going to have to compute the log 10 of something. And yes, there is it is over. So we're going to do something. All right, so we're going to put 57 on top and put the 2 on the bottom. Okay, so this is called the change of base formula. Graphically, see how this is high and this is low? You can think of this being the upper number and this is the lower number, if you want. And then you can work out why that looks the way it is by converting everything into exponentials. But anyways. Okay, so let's do some examples of applying this formula. Okay, so we'll start with the coin toss, and we'll just make sure it has the property that we want. Okay, what's the log 2 of 0.5? Okay, we should be able to do this without a calculator, right? So let's just call it Z. We don't know what it is yet. Okay, we can rewrite this as log 2 of 1/2. Okay, how do I... So I can move this over to the other side. Right, so we could say 2 to the z equals 1/2. 1/2 is 2 to the what?
Minus 1.
Minus 1, right? So what's z? Okay. Right. So on an exam, you know, you should be able to do logarithms without a calculator. Okay, so it's minus 1. Okay, so this is going to equal minus 0.5 times minus 1 minus 0.5 times minus 1. And if I did my math right, then that should come up to 1. Okay. So the first thing that weirds people out is, why is this minus sign always there, right? Well, remember, probabilities are always going to be between 0 or 1. Okay. They're always going to be a decimal. And the logarithm of anything between 0 and 1 is always going to be a negative number. Okay. So that's why this minus sign is there. It's just going to cancel out the negative number. Yeah, and then otherwise, it's just more of a weighted average kind of thing. Okay, so once again, if you don't understand it, doesn't matter. Just know how to apply it. So let's think about a dice. So singular for die is dice, or sorry, singular for dice is actually plural. We call it a die if there's just one of them. And so the probability is going to be 1/6. Okay. Okay. And anytime you have the same probability that's repeated, then you don't have to write it out. You might use the summation formula. That's probably a little bit better. So we're going to have 6 of these. So it's going to be 1/6 times log 2 of 1/6. Okay. And that repeated 6 times is just going to be 6 times that. Okay. Okay, look, this cancels out. That's nice. Okay, and so if you compute this out, we get 2.58 bits. Let's write bits up here. So what does that intuitively mean? 2.5. Okay, well, remember, one bit is a coin toss. Okay, so for example, let's say you're playing a game and you need to roll a die between 1 and 6, but all you have is a coin. Okay. So what you want to do is you want to flip that coin a certain number of times, and what you're going to do is you're going to convert that somehow into a roll of the dice, okay? How are you going to do it? Well, first, the first question is, how many times are you going to have to flip the coin, right? So if you flip it twice, right, how many different outcomes do you get? Let's start from the base case, actually. So let's say you flip it once. How many outcomes are you going to get? Two, okay, heads or tails. What kind of, how many sides would a dice have to have for that to match? No, sorry, like what?
A coin has sides.
So if a two-sided die would be the same as a coin, effectively. Okay, it's sort of a weird thing to say, but anyways. Okay, now let's say you have two coins. How many outcomes do you have?
Four.
You have four outcomes, right? Heads, 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 tails, tails, heads, tails, tails. Okay, so two coin flips is like a four-sided die. Okay, now let's say you have three coins. How many outcomes do you have? Eight. Okay. So that's like an eight-sided die. Okay. Now a six-sided die is more random than a four-sided die, but it's less random than an eight-sided die. Okay. So it's going to be more random than two coins and less random than three coins. Okay. So it's going to be somewhere in between two and three. Okay. It's 2.58. That's exactly where between two coin flips and three coin flips it is. Okay. So what you can think of is this takes any weird randomness thing that you want, and there's no reason these all have to be uniform, so we'll get to non-uniform distributions in a second, and it converts it into the number of coins you would have to flip to replicate that amount of randomness, okay? So you can think of it as a sort of conversion between your weird dice object and a certain number of coin flips that you actually want to achieve. Okay, so two coins give you four outcomes, or a four-sided die. Three coins is like an eight-sided die. we're talking about a six-sided die. It's going to be somewhere between 2 and 3. It's 2.58. Okay, let's consider a bias coin. So let's say the probability of heads is 1/3. The probability of tails is 2/3. So we're going to have minus 1/3 log 2 1/3. Minus 2/3 log 2 2/3. And if you work it out, you get 0.52 plus 0.39 equals 0.9. Okay? So what's the intuition there? Well, an unbiased coin gives you one bit of entropy. When we bias the coin, right, then the entropy is going down, right? Our uncertainty about the event is going down. It's not going all the way to zero, right? We still don't know whether it's going to be heads or tails. We just have a better sense of what it will be. So we would expect some entropy between zero and one, okay? In this case, it's 0.9. So it's almost as good as an unbiased coin, but not quite, okay? Another thing just to consider is, what if the probability of tails was 1/3 and the probability of heads was 2/3? So we flip them. Doesn't matter, right? Doesn't make a difference. The amount of randomness is the same. We're just changing the labels that we apply to the outcome. And so what will happen is you'll just reverse the numbers in this formula. You'll still have these two terms. They'll just be in a different order, right? And it's going to give you the same result as well, okay? So order doesn't matter in terms of your probability distribution as well, okay? Now, there's some other theories about information theory. You can take a bunch of things. Basically, once you fix the number of items in your probability distribution, so let's say it's 6, then the maximum randomness that you can get out is when the probability is uniform. So it's 1/6 in this case, okay? Or if you think of a coin, you have 2 outcomes, so the maximum randomness will be 1/2 and 1/2, okay? Any deviation from that will always result in less randomness, okay? So when we have a probability distribution where there's n elements, and the probability of each one is 1/n, we call that a uniform distribution. Okay, so you'll hear the term uniform randomness. What that means is if it's a binary string and it's n bits long, we're choosing each bit with probability exactly 1/2 for each of them, and that's uniformly random. And that's the most random way that we could choose that n bit string. Okay, there's no more random way that we could do by, you know, choosing any bit with some different distribution. Okay, and that should match your intuition. But you can see how this formula will actually formalize that, and you can get numbers out that match that intuition. Okay, let's say we roll a dice 10 times. Or actually, let's put it slightly differently. Let's say we roll 10 dice. Okay.
1/10.
So what it's going to do is, yeah, it's going to equal, well, you can think of it that way, but it's not going to be 1/10 because there's more than 10 outcomes per dice. So you have 6 outcomes times 10. So you could work out what all the probabilities are. They'll give you the right answer. Or you can cheat and you can say, well, I know the entropy of one dice roll, right? And then what I can do is I can just multiply it by 10, okay? Because I'm repeating. Now, the one condition in order to do this is they have to be what we call independent events, okay? And so dice, it's very obvious that it's independent. What does that mean? It means when you roll the dice the second time, it doesn't matter what the outcome of the first roll was. It's not going to influence the second roll in any sense, okay? So technically they have to be independent to play this trick, but we're never going to see something non-independent. Okay, so it's going to be 10 times the entropy of one dice roll. We work that out to be 2.58. So it would be 25.8. Move the decimal over 1. Okay, questions so far? Okay, so that's what entropy is. You have a formula for it. It's kind of weird looking, but if you write it down and put the numbers in, it behaves very much like you would want it to behave. It's going to give you a number between 0 and infinity. If it's 0, that means there's no randomness there. It's certain. If it's 1, that means it has as much randomness as a single coin flip. If it's more, it's like flipping a coin a certain number of times or a certain number of coins. They're equivalent. If you flip 10 coins once or if you flip the same coin 10 times, they're the same. Okay, so the next thing we're going to talk about is, so there's no questions on that? Everyone's good? Okay. Next thing we're going to talk about is something called an extractor. And I spelled it wrong. Okay, an extractor is going to look a lot like a hash function. It's a single input, single output. Just like a hash function, the output will have a certain size, and we can even call it D if we want. And sometimes people use hash functions as extractors. We'll get into that in a second. And what we want from an extractor, though, is slightly different in terms of properties. Okay, what we want is... So we'll have an input, and the input can technically be any size, but we're going to put a restriction on it, okay? Okay, this is going to be a little bit weird of a definition, okay? What's going to happen is, let's say we have a bit string and it's d bits long, okay? How much entropy is in a bit string that's d bits long? So we can't say with certainty it's exactly this amount, but we can put bounds on it. So what's the least amount of entropy that could be in a d bit string? Zero. And what's the most? So it's not infinity, okay? Think of a coin. If I have a coin, it's one, or one bit is a coin. What's the most entropy I can have for one coin?
The size of the set.
Right, which is 2, okay? So these are binary strings. There's 2 outcomes, right? So what's the maximum entropy I can have? It's 1, right? So I can have some number less than 1, but the most I can have is 1, okay? Now I have a d-bit string. What's the most entropy I can have? D, right? I can never have more than D bits of entropy if I don't have more than D bits, okay? So the most entropy I can have in a D bit string is D bits, okay? When do I have exactly D bits of entropy? What can you say about the probability distribution? It's uniformly random. Every bit is a coin toss, okay? If there's D bits, it's like flipping D coins. Each coin is 1 bit. D times 1 is D, okay? So that's the ideal output, okay? So let me just write a note of this so we're sort of on the same page. I'll put binary string. Okay. So what I want for this extractor is, there's a lot of times in crypto where you have to choose random numbers, or you have to choose keys, which are random numbers, and they have to be secret, and you really want them to be uniformly random. So every single bit is as likely to be a zero as it is to be a one, okay? Now, unfortunately, you don't have coins in a computer. Okay, a computer doesn't have a coin that it can flip. Okay, what your computer has is it has a bunch of randomness. It can look at, like, when you boot up your computer, exactly to the like millisecond, how long do certain operations take, and they kind of fluctuate. Or you might have like a certain component, like a diode or a capacitor or something, and it's kind of noisy, so you can measure the noise off of it. So there are kind of like sources of randomness that your computer has access to, but none of them are like a clean source of randomness like coin flips, okay? Think about noise. Noise is kind of random, but there's also kind of a structure there, right? If you tune in your radio to a radio station, part of what you're hearing is signal, which is predictable, unrandom. And the other part is noise. It's like kind of the static that's over top. Okay? So most real-world things that you go out and measure have a kind of mix of signal and noise. They have some randomness, but they're not uniformly random. Okay? So we consider them to be semi-random. Okay? And I'll give you some concrete examples of what semi-random means. Okay? So what we want is we want a function that will take our semi-randomness and kind of filter out just the randomness itself, okay? Or you can think of it more like a compression function. So you have this big, long, kind of semi-random thing, and you're going to squish it down to something that's truly random, okay? Now, you have to make sure that that long semi-random thing has enough randomness. If your output's going to be d bits of randomness, right? Your input has to have at least d bits of randomness. Otherwise, you're not getting d bits of randomness out. Okay, you can't. Randomness doesn't come out of nowhere. Okay, right. And so, what you're going to end up with is you can think of a long string that has d bits of randomness in there, and you're just going to squish it down so it's exactly d bits. And if you can keep all those d bits of randomness, then now you have a uniformly random d bit string. Okay. Now the problem is our extractors don't work perfectly. Okay, so they can't perfectly extract d bits of entropy. You can think of writing, and no one knows exactly how they work, but you can write down some bounds under certain assumptions where you're going to lose about half of your randomness when you do this squish. Okay, so you're going to do the squishing function, you're going to lose half your randomness. So if you want d bits at the end, you're going to have to start with twice that amount in the beginning. Okay. So what you're going to do is you're going to go out, and your computer literally does this. What it does is it boots up and it harvests randomness from anywhere it can find it. When you click on your keyboard, right? Like what's the exact intervals between each time you click? When I move my mouse around, right? If I move from here to here, there's a bunch of different trajectories that I could take. And every time I'll do a slightly different one if you go right down to the pixel level. Okay? So it's harvesting this randomness over time. And then what it will do is it will squish it down. And eventually it will squish it down to a nice size number. Okay? A nice size number would be something like 112 bits. And we'll talk about this later. But once it gets that 112 bits, then it can actually stretch it back out. You can stretch that randomness back out in a secure way. Okay. Now, how much entropy is in you wiggling your mouse around? No one really knows. Okay. But we can make estimates of what it is. And the idea is that we're going to get X so it's much, much greater than 2D. Okay. It's going to be like 1,000D by the most conservative estimates, and then we'll do our extraction from it. Okay, so we're going to just harvest an obscene amount of entropy and then do this kind of process and hope that we have enough, because you can never really say how random something actually is when it's like these sort of, you know, computer-based things, because a computer is strictly deterministic, right? There's nothing actually truly random about it, okay? So that's an extractor, okay? So the best extractors that we have that are general purpose extractors, where you can stick in a hash function or some other cryptographic function in for that function, they require at least 2D input, okay? Then everything works and you can prove some theorems about them working, okay? So for the course, for the sake of this course, we'll assume that we have at least 2D, okay? Now, there's one caveat, which is that we want actually something that's called min entropy, not Shannon entropy. It's slightly different. It's kind of like a worst case entropy where Shannon is an average case. I used to teach it. I taught it last year, but this year it's such an inconsequential point that I'm not going to confuse you by defining two different types of entropy. Okay, if you really want to know, it's the logarithm of the greatest probability in your probability distribution. So you go through your probability distribution, you pick out the maximum value, take the logarithm base 2, negate it, and then that gives you the min entropy. Okay, and min entropy is like the amount of extractable entropy. But for our purposes, we'll just gloss over that particular detail. Okay, so where we're going with this is we want to drop a cryptographic primitive in to solve this problem for you, and we're going to be able to do that. But I want to make sure that we get the concept. So I'm going to show you a special extractor. It's kind of like a brain teaser, just to get you thinking about what does it mean, like a long semi-random string getting shrunken down to a truly random string. It's kind of a weird concept. So I'll give you a simple example, and then we'll just say, thou shalt use a hash function, you know, in the future in order to do this, okay? So the example is called the von Neumann extractor. Okay, so you're not going to actually use this if you build some cryptography. Okay, so here's the setup. Let's say that you're playing a game, and for whatever reason, the game's based on randomness, and you need to flip a coin, okay? So you're playing some game based on heads, tails, okay? The problem is you only have a biased coin. So you have a coin, 60% heads, 40% tails, okay? But what you want to do is you want to simulate having a real coin, okay? So how can you do it? So let's be concrete, and we'll say, so let's say here. So let's say that it flips heads 60% of the time and it flips tails 40% of the time. First off, in theory, is it possible that we could maybe play this game with this biased coin? Or is it just right out of the question? Yeah. Yeah, you can have such a coin, but could we play a coin? Could we play a game requiring a fair coin if all we have is a biased coin? Okay, so we're not sure exactly how we're going to do it, but the point is there is randomness here, right? We need randomness, right? That's what a coin toss is. We have something that's giving us randomness. It's just not giving it to us in the format that we want, right? We want something that's 50-50, okay? Yeah.
Like, multiplying
Okay, so what do you want to do exactly?
For example, the person who's supposed to get head multiplies his result by one over two.
Okay. Okay, so you're on you're thinking the right way. That's not exactly the solution.
Can you like earlier on we mapped it to a six-sided die kind of thing?
Yeah.
So if you do it, if you take this game in that way, then maybe you can achieve the same result.
Okay. So let's think about a related question. Just forget about how we're going to do it. Just from an entropy perspective, let's say we need one coin toss. We need one bit of entropy. Is flipping this coin once going to give us one bit of entropy? No. Okay. So if we flip it twice, will it? Probably we'd have to work out what the entropy is. But the point is, if we flip this bias coin enough times, we can get the randomness sort of on the table in order to have enough randomness for one true coin flip. Okay. So that's the first key. The first key is that we're not going to flip this coin. If we have to flip the fair coin 10 times, if we're going to use this bias coin, we're going to have to flip it sometime more than 10 times. Okay. Okay, so we're going to have to flip it more than once to simulate one fair flip. Okay, so now we're looking at how do we map flipping this a couple times into flipping a true coin once. Okay, well, let's write it down. So I actually wrote a little script that flipped this bias coin. I did it 20 times, and this was the output. So we have heads, 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 tails, heads, heads. There was a lot of heads, which we expect. This doesn't look very random. One of the funny things is that when you actually, I'll tell this story in a second. So there was a statistics professor, this is like a story, I don't know if it's actually true, but he gave an assignment where he's like, okay, you either have to go in a room and flip a coin, like some amount of time that it would actually take a while to do, I think like 100 times or 1,000 times, or you can just make up a random sequence, okay? And I'm going to try and guess which one you did. And for all the students that made it up, he could tell right away. And the reason he could tell is because when you're trying to write down something that looks random, it's really hard to write down heads like this, a big streak of heads. Almost no one who made up randomness would do it, but that's actually like fairly likely. If you have like a long, like 1,000 coin flips, like having a really, really long string of all heads or all tails is like more likely than you would think. And so that's how you could quickly like sort the true randomness from the fake randomness. So anyways, just because we have that long string doesn't mean it wasn't random. Like I said, this was an actual generation up from a script, okay? All right, so what we want to do is we want to take this sequence and we want to get some fair coin tosses out of it. So how can we do it? First off, can we just use that? Like say we're playing the game, we need 20 coin tosses. Can we use that output sequence as is? So we can't, right? Because it's biased. Now remember, it's also I defined this extractor thing. And what was the extractor? Well, it's kind of like you had this long semi-random string. What's a long semi-random string? That's a long semi-random string, okay? It's 20 bits, right? You can think of these as zeros and ones instead of heads and tails. It's not uniformly random, okay? Because the probability of getting a heads is slightly greater than getting a tails, okay? So this is not a uniformly random bit string, but there is some randomness there. It's not like before I flipped the coins, I could write down exactly what it was, okay? So it's a string that has some randomness there. It just doesn't have a uniform amount of randomness. What I want to do in extractor is I want to output a shorter string that actually has true randomness, okay? Where everything I write down is either heads or tails, and when I write down heads, that there was a 50% chance that that happened. Or if I write down tails, there was a 50% chance that that happened. Okay? So what we can do is, does anyone want to hazard a guess? Okay. So 2 out of 3 in terms of... Okay, so you're idea is roughly right, which is what we want to do is we do want to chunk up this output. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to consider outputs. Let's consider a pair of outputs. Okay, now if we consider this pair, okay, what's the probability distribution of this pair of outputs? What are the options for these two coin tosses? What are the all the options that we could have for these first two coin tosses? So here we see heads, right? That's one option. We could have heads, tails. We could have tails, heads. We could have tails, tails. Okay. What's the probability of heads, heads? So it's not a quarter. It is a quarter in a fair coin toss, right? But remember, this is a biased coin. Okay, so it's going to be 0.6 times 0.6, right? So it's going to happen about 36% of the time. Okay? Now, what if we have tails, tails? 0.4. So 16% of the times, we're going to see tails, tails. What about these two values? Okay, so we're going to get 24%. This one will be the inverse. 24%. Okay, does anyone see any ideas now that we've considered this? Say it loud. If you have an idea, say it loud. So what are we going for? We want something that's equally likely. Okay, what's equally likely here? Okay, so these two events are equally likely, right? The probability of getting a heads, tails, and getting a tails, heads are the same, okay? So what we could do is, every time we see a heads, heads, we could throw it out. Every time we see a tails, tails, we could throw it out. If we see a heads, tails, we could call that heads. And if we see a tails, heads, we could call that tails. Then what's the probability when we write this down? The probability will be a half and a half, okay? So what we'll do is we're going to toss this. We're going to toss this case. We'll call this heads, and we'll call this tails, okay? So what we'll do is we'll go through here. So we're going to toss this. We have a heads, tails, okay? Heads, tails says we write down heads, so we replace that with heads. Heads, heads, we'll toss. Heads, heads, we'll toss. Heads, heads, we'll toss. Heads, heads, we'll toss. We have tail heads. So we'll call that tails. Call this tails. We'll toss this. And we'll call this heads. Okay? And so what we're going to do is we're going to take this long semi-random string. We're going to compress it to a shorter string, which is going to be heads, tails, tails, heads. Okay? So it took 20 coin flips to generate 4 coin flips, but what can we say about what was the probability that this was heads as opposed to tails? It was a half, right? It was 50-50, okay? Because we only got it because of this case, and this case is as likely as this case, okay? So this is a uniformly random bit string. Okay? So what we did is, now, let's say we want to generate 5 coins. How many coins of our bias coin do we have to flip? Exactly. So we don't know. Okay. So this extractor is actually non-deterministic in the sense that we don't know how many coins. We're going to keep flipping coins until we happen to get 5 either head, tails, or tails, heads. We can write down some probabilities when that would happen and try and get some bounds, but we won't know specifically what it is, okay? So that's one reason why this extractor doesn't work well in practice is because you never know when to stop, right? You don't know beforehand when you're going to have to stop. The other thing is it's specific to flipping coins, right? It has nothing to do with anything else. You have to know, okay, here's another question. So what if we change these probabilities? So instead of it being 60-40, let's say it's 80-20. Okay, what changes?
More heads, more tails.
Okay, so we're going to get more heads and less tails. Okay, is our extractor going to change itself? Is this rule going to change?
No.
Okay, the rule will say the same. Okay, but what's going to happen is this probability is going to get way bigger. This one's going to get way smaller, and these are going to get smaller as well. Okay, so the more skewed this coin gets, the smaller these probabilities get. Okay, what does that mean? What's the consequence? That's right. It's going to, so 20 coins gave us 4, right? The more skewed this gets, 20 coins might give us 3 or 2 or 1, okay, or 0, right? We might have to flip 1,000 coins, okay? So the amount that this probability is skewed from uniform randomness, sort of like the less bits that you can extract, okay? So the sort of less random your input string gets, the more of it you need in order to extract the same amount, okay? And so all of this is like, these are really good lessons for thinking about how extractors work, okay? So what you want to do is you want to get a really long string where there's some randomness there, and you want to make sure that if your output is going to be a certain amount of randomness, you have much more than that amount of randomness spread out amongst your input string itself, okay? All right, now, so this is a cute example just to give you kind of the intuition of what's going on. In general, we typically use a hash function as an extractor. In theory, you should... So there's theoretical reasons why you shouldn't use a hash function. Everyone does it in practice. It's kind of bad. You should use something called an HMAC or something called CBCMAC. These things we'll see later in class. Okay. SSL does use a hash function. They're changing it now. So the new version does it completely differently. But version 1.2 and previous... there is a point, and we'll identify that exact point, but it's going to be like the very last lecture because we have to get through a lot before we get there. But there is an extractor that you need to map something down to a uniformly random number, and they just use a hash function for it. All right, so use cases. The first is that protocol HTTPS, or I'll say, let me write it. I'll write it this way. HTTP over SSL TLS, which is a big mouthful, also known as HTTPS. So this is the thing that gives you that lock on websites. You don't have to worry about what this is for now. We'll circle back to it later. And the second thing I mentioned is that your computer does this. Every time it boots up, it does this. Okay, so what exactly does your computer do? So what it does is it just starts harvesting entropy from wherever it can find it. Particular user input, so it's impossible to predict exactly what a user input will look like. So harvests entropy from uncertain events such as user input over time. And then when it thinks it has enough or it sees you asking for it, then what it will do is it will run it through an extractor. It doesn't use a hash. It uses something that's a little more complicated that the details don't matter. You can look at that for a project if you want. And it outputs what we're going to call a seed. Okay. And so a seed will be statistically close or statistically near uniform random, which is just a fancy way of saying it's basically uniform random, but we have a little wiggle room for technical reasons. So statistically near uniform random, and it's usually, you know, like 128 bits or something like that. We'll say it's greater than 112 bits. Okay. And then what we can do is next class, we'll talk about something called a PRG. Okay. Once you get enough randomness, 112 bits, then what you can do is you can stretch that randomness into any amount of randomness you need. And even though when you stretch it, you're not introducing new randomness, because your seed started off as such a big value, no one can kind of go backwards or predict new bits without trying every possible seed value, and the seed value is just too big. So next class, what we'll do is... we'll look at these PRG functions, okay? And what they'll do is they'll take a truly random seed and they'll kind of stretch the randomness out. So this will give you any size randomness. And technically it's not true randomness, so we'll use the term pseudo randomness. Okay, everyone's excited to leave. They heard me say next class. Okay, we do have 5 minutes. I'll try not to use all of that 5 minutes. But so what's pseudo-randomness? You can think of it as there's three kinds of definitions of randomness. We don't care for this class. If you start writing crypto papers, you're going to care a lot about it. But there's true randomness. That's like flipping coins. The output of an extractor, we said, is statistically close. That just means if you look at the output of an extractor and you look at real coin tosses, you can't tell the difference using a statistical test. And pseudo-randomness means if you tell a computer, look at the output of this function and look at true random coins, the computer won't be able to tell the difference because it can't compute powerfully enough. It can't do enough operations to actually distinguish the two. Okay, so pseudo-randomness means it's secure from a computer telling the difference between its output and an actual true random output, okay? All right, questions? Yeah?
So for this, the statistically near uniform randomness to the seed, the user will still have to go like 2 to the D effort to get a collision.
It won't be collisions that you're trying to find, but there is something that you're trying to find, and it's going to be 2 to the D work to do it. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
So the randomness, if I did it correctly, that means the computer cannot tell if it's random or not.
Yeah, that's right.
It is kind of a random for the computer.
Yeah, so it's random looking. Yeah, yeah. So it's not, it can be a little further from randomness than this, but a computer still won't be able to tell a difference. Okay. And not just my computer, like any computer. The sum of all computational power for the lifetime of the universe won't be able to tell the difference. Yeah, so it's deterministic. That's why it's not random, is because this function is deterministic. So we're taking an input, we're making an output that's bigger. Because it's deterministic, we're not actually introducing any randomness. So how can we say that this output is random? Well, what we'll say instead is that a computer can't tell the difference. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, thanks. I'll see you next week.